I couldn't have got a better subject. I must thank the General Secretary for suggesting this subject. It's one that's entirely in line with my thinking of the recent of recent months, perhaps, which makes things ever so much easier to get a subject that really appeals to you. It sets you going. Now, the word survival is in this title, and so really, it is a question of the survival of the human race. Now, this is beginning to be taken seriously, but I think that even in the next few years, it's going to come home to humanity, the fact that survival of life on this planet is problematical. And I can show you heaps and heaps of books about this. I have a young family that indoctrinate me in these ideas and lend me all the books, and I, because of them, seem to keep up to date. Now, I don't know what has been said at the convention, which this theme of brotherhood was, I think, the keynote. But I'm going to start on my own ground and put forward my own ideas. And please, they may sound dogmatic, but they're not meant to be. They're really trying to stimulate all of us towards thinking. You see, I think the society has put forward successfully the idea of brotherhood. It has now been accepted by many nations and many peoples in the world. But the way in which brotherhood will be achieved is something that it's very, very difficult for us to understand. And that, of course, is what we want to talk about. I think that we have sort of gone along our own narrow lines and expected that the working out of brotherhood would follow on from our talks and theories on brotherhood. But I don't think that's going to happen. We've set the forces going. The way in which those forces work out is going to be something that is not what we expected, or what we expect. Now, the first point I want to make about brotherhood is that brotherhood is a reality in the worlds beyond the physical, the emotional, and the mental. In other words, in the worlds beyond the world of the personality. This is a fundamental concept to all theosophical thinking. If you take this as the center of a oneness, complete unity, and here you have Atma Buddhi Manas, the reality of the spiritual self, outside that you have the astral, you have the mental, the lower mental, that is, we call it, the mental, the astral, and the physical. Now, if you look at this diagram, which some of you may have seen before, it was in the course we had in Auckland, you will find that the line, if you take that point as an individual unit of life, it goes back to this line here, which is the differentiation between the personality and the spiritual self, which is the midpoint of the astral plane. It is the point, of course, of the bridge of mind, Anapadaka. I'm sorry, not Anapadaka, Antikarana. Now, that point is separate until it reaches this. After that, the lines crisscross and have relationship one to the other. So in this world of isolation, below that line, we are separate units of being. And the reality in here is that which is causes life, but which is forgotten. And the basic concept is that all life actually comes from within the circle of unity and is projected out into the world of separativeness. And the realization of brotherhood is the bringing of the concepts of unity from the level of Atma Buddhi Manas and above into the world of the personality of thought, feeling, and physical action. I think you can have me on about this afterwards, but I think that that is a basic concept of what brotherhood actually is. Now, the purpose of life is growth. I remember the first time I heard Mr. Hodgson say that. It stuck in my mind. It seemed to be a very, very good way of putting it. And in terms of evolution or evolutionary terms, the growth for us and for all life is the increasing expression of that which comes from inside the circle of Atma Buddhimanas into the world of personality. And as I said before, the realization of brotherhood is the same process. It is the reality of unity and of oneness being expressed in the outer world of separativeness. And this applies to all individuals and to life in its entirety. The second aspect of brotherhood is just as important, I think. If you throw a stone into a pond, the stone displaces every particle of water in that pond. In fact, if you threw a stone into an ocean, you would displace every particle of water in that ocean. And this also applies, you remember Francis Thompson, you can't so-and-so, but you troubleth the star, the distant star. If the basis of astrology, of course, is that this question of interrelationship extends beyond the confines of the earth to the whole of the solar system, and possibly beyond. Now, the understanding of the interrelationship of all life is today called ecology. And this word, not very old, probably about the 1930s, it started to be used. And the study of the relationships between plants, animals, and even humans is called ecology. And any system based on ecology, or any system of ecology, is called an ecosystem. A lovely word, again, quite new in its form, an ecosystem. And the new science is a study of ecology is really a study of natural brotherhood. Brotherhood as it exists in nature, the relation of one life or unit of life to another. I know that we say that there's brotherhood in nature, it's a fact in nature and so on. And then you get up against this idea of red and tooth and claw, that there are levels of life that live on other levels of life, carnivorous and even those who are herbivorous, actually eat and live on other systems. But this, I think, is something the importance of which we have to, shall I say, we have to condone as part of the world in which we live. Now, one of the most important things about ecology is that it's the multiplicity of the units that makes the strength of the ecosystem. Once you get a system in which there's a breakdown and a limitation in the multiplicity of units of life, then you get an imbalance and then you get trouble. I was reading in this little book at the Aerodrome before I came in here, just to get myself back with the subject, about the use of DDT. Now, DDT actually kills out, first of all, the carnivorous insects. And then it kills the vegetation-eating insects. But the carnivorous insects themselves live on those that are eating the vegetation. And so you've got a greater obstacle to overcome. You've got to use more DDT because you've killed off the carnivorous ones that would have eaten the parasites that were eating the vegetation. You see this sort of thing? And this is going on all the time at the moment. Another thing they say is that there's no one animal in any natural surrounding that eats every tree. Perhaps the opossum comes pretty near it, I don't know. But you see, most animals eat a particular type of tree. In other words, they only upset part of the natural surroundings. But when you use what's this thing that they've been using in Vietnam, where defoliate the whole of the forest, you kill the whole lot. You upset the balance completely in one throw. And don't forget, those of you who have traveled in the Middle East, that the whole of Palestine, for instance, and Persia were fertile at one time, and now they're mainly desert. And if you read these books, you'll find out that this is very nearly happening in most parts of the world today. Now, Christian man, the Judeo-Christian is the way it was put in one book, which I think is a rather good way of putting it, because our Christianity is based on the Jewish concept. Christian man has put himself against nature and is trying, and in some extent succeeding, in being the master of nature. Now, most other religious forms of religion have worshipped the sun or worshipped some natural phenomena, and by doing that have recognized their subservience or their need to cooperate with natural forces. But Christian man in the Western world has said, I will rule nature. And this is a very, very dangerous thing to have done. And it's only now that's been recognized that it was danger. We're only realizing now that we're upsetting the ecosystems which are our heritage and which are necessary if life is to survive on this spacecraft. That's what he's called it now. This is a spacecraft, cut off from everything else except perhaps the energy of the sun. The first one that we came across was hormone weed killers. And this is one that I thought most interesting, because the hormone weed killer affects the etheric growth pattern of a plant. And it makes the plant expand its growth to such an extent that it goes beyond its resources, and it kills itself by rapid growth. Now, this is beginning to work at the levels of the astro-mental, and the etheric being the transmitter of that levels of the level of pattern, if you like, the growth pattern. And so when we invented hormone weed killers, we took upon ourselves to alter the basis of nature and to upset brotherhood. The other, of course, is the rape of the top 9 inches of the Earth's surface, which supports all life, with the exception of that which is supported in the sea. Superphosphate, the use of unlimited use of superphosphate, cutting down the trees and so on. And one of the very interesting examples is the Aswan Dam that the Russians have built in Egypt. This was going to solve all the problems, because there would be ample water from that dam to irrigate the whole of the Egyptian delta. And what's actually happening now, they've realized too late that by damming the Aswan, they have no longer got the condition of periodic or yearly floods. And those floods used to take the silt down and fertilize the whole of the Nile Delta. And now man, in his wisdom or lack of wisdom, has built a dam. He's upset the natural process, and it looks as though the whole thing will be a ghastly failure and will be to the detriment of the whole of Egypt. The next one, I'm just going through these very quickly, is oxygen. This isn't one of our immediate problems, but if we go on at the rate we are in the next 100 years, perhaps we'll run out of oxygen. Now, 60% of the oxygen that is generated in the Earth is generated by the plasma in the sea. Plankton. The plankton. Now, there are two types. There's the animal and the vegetable. The vegetable plankton is the one that absorbs absorbs CO2 and gives off oxygen. And of course, in the presence of sunshine, plants do the same thing. Well, now, with all the fuels we're burning, the fossil fuels, they call them, that's oil and coal, we are creating a lot of extra CO2. And with the supersonic jets and things, they say there's going to be a glasshouse effect in the upper atmosphere that's going to retain the heat. And if this goes on, if this question of the generation of a lot more CO2, carbon dioxide, that is, and carbon monoxide, then we'll get the melting of the ice caps. And this is quite a reality. This could happen. If the ice caps melt, the sea will rise hundreds of feet. And as this book put it, you'll have gondolas calling at the post office tower in London. I don't know what's the height of the post office tower, probably a couple of hundred feet, perhaps more. Then there's the question of smog. This is the same cause. You know that quite recently, these things just happened in the last few years, London got over it. London spent money and reduced the smog. Los Angeles, as those of you who've been there will know, is covered in smog most of the time. But it's in Japan that this has been worst, and you know that there has been epidemic illness among the school children of Japan, where they've had to stay away from school just because of the impurity of the air they were breathing. Now, the point is that these are worldwide problems, and efforts towards their solution is forcing mankind towards brotherhood. because we all are sharing the same problem. The underdeveloped countries, Africa, India, and other parts of Asia, see the advantage of a higher standard of living, and in doing that, they're working towards the ideal of human of Western life, and they are accepting all these problems and creating all these problems. And it's almost impossible to stop them because they want to be like our Western affluent neighbors and have plenty of money and have all the conveniences of the Western world. Now, in some fields, the problems of the undeveloped countries are greater. Population explosion is one. I'm reading the book just a short time. I've got the figures in my mind. In some countries, the population of the country is doubling itself in 20 years. In the developed countries like America and probably New Zealand, it's 40, 50, or 60 years. But the population of the Earth will double itself in 25 years from now. And where's the food going to come from? There, according to these people, this is the population bomb, 1967, the book that stirred the earth. The effects in it are really staggering. It's written by a Dr. Paul R. Ehrlich, E-H-R-L-I-C-H, Ehrlich perhaps it is. But anyway, there he points out the difficulties of manufacturing water from seawater, the capacity, I think, of the present stills or what have you is 20,000 gallons a day as against the 600 gallons a day that the United States needs. Those are the sort of figures. Making fish farming, for instance, just not on. The coast of New Zealand is being raped for lobsters and crayfish from one end of the other. I've just been down Milford Sound and there's crayfish boats all over that coast. And you know what went on? They just cleaned out the Chatham Islands, and we're the most isolated part of the world that probably has a better chance of than any other part of the world in surviving in the ecological sense. You know, it happened to the whales. It's happening. The Japanese fishermen are coming down here, and the Russians off our coast. The farming of the sea is just not on, according to these people. And they say the same applies to the use of artificial foods and soya beans and those sort of things. It's a little depressing to read what they have to say about the manufacture of new and additional foods. So, here what we're up against. Food available, doubtful. One child per second is dying of starvation in the world today. Now, we in the TS have talked about God's plan. How is it that God's plan, which we so glibly talk about, is going to solve this problem? There are many scientists today who feel that one of the greatest dangers, as they put it, that it could be an instrument of God's plan, is the possibility of a plague. You know that now aircraft can bring cholera, as recently happened, into New Zealand, even Australia. And the sort of the balance reaching the point where these can get out of hand completely is not very far away. The possibility of a worldwide virulent influenza epidemic, for instance, is very real, according to these thinking people. Earthquakes? I don't know. Contraceptives, the use of contraceptives is far too slow. He goes into the whole problem here as far as India, population in India, and it's very interesting reading. I won't go into it tonight. And of course it's in the underdeveloped countries that population growth is so great. I remember Mr. Vere Hunt, in some of you may know, Mr. Crawford, Miss Hunt's brother. He wrote a book some years ago in Christchurch, when some of you remember it. It was called Populate or Perish, because he said, if we don't populate New Zealand, the Japanese and the Chinese will come in. Nowadays it will be populate and perish. So the whole aim of modern thought, the thought of the last 5 or 10 years, is negative. Zero population growth. Zero economic growth. And such ideas, if they're carried out, require the sacrifice of individual freedom, the sacrifice of every individual, And part of that sacrifice will be the lowering of living standards. Instead of coming to work in your car, you'll come on your bicycle because it doesn't pollute the atmosphere. Instead of getting a new car every day, the cars of the future will be, and this is beginning to happen, the cars of the future will be made to last much longer than they are now because we're wasting the minerals at such a great rate, we're going to run out. Now, the General Secretary or the editor of the magazine, or both, I don't know, sent me this book called Fields Within Fields, Within Fields. And it's by Julius Stoltman, or he's the publisher, but it's an epitome of American advanced thinking. And there are many who feel that the solution of this problem is still going to come from the highest intelligences of America. I think, I don't know, but this man worked with Fritz Kunz. He quotes him in one or two places. In the sense, it's a sort of a continuation of main currents. Now, in that book, there is an article which I think is called The Choice. If I can find it. Key Choices of the Next Two Decades. Key Choices of the Next Two Decades. And I'll quote some of it sort of in my own words, but it's basically taken from this book. Where have we gone wrong? He says that individual, that's choices by individuals, by corporations, and by government people, have been guided in the past by such principles as economic growth as a self-justifying end. Economic growth, which in itself is an ideal, without considering the consequences of such action. Business, the business of business, is business. And this is the cycle that we have today, just the same as the inflationary cycle, which is impossible to solve itself. It will only go on and on until something goes wrong and the whole thing breaks down. They say that micro-decisions, decisions made by the individual, even if right, become wrong macro-decisions when they're applied to the whole of the environment or the whole of the world when it comes to human activity. So what we do as individuals, although it might be right from our point of view, is often very wrong from the point of view of the whole of humanity. Self-interest, short-term, instead of enlightened self-interest, which is long-term for the good of all. And these are the contributing factors to the trouble which has suddenly come upon us. It's our realization of the trouble that has suddenly come upon us. And he points out the factors that make this important. And these are interesting in view of what I said earlier about brotherhood and the fact that brotherhood as an idea is accepted or is understood in the world. Interconnectedness. Laissez-faire, that's sort of let somebody alone, let them get on with it in their own way, is not possible now because of reduction in frontiers. Travel is so much easier. And so on. The nations of the earth are connected, linked. What happens in Africa used to be of no interest at all to people living in Europe or in New Zealand, but now what happens anywhere in the world has an effect upon us. We're approaching the limits of recycling capabilities. In other words, we're going to run out of all sorts of things. We have more material and educational advances. And the result of this is higher expectations, just as is happening in the underdeveloped countries. They want to be like the West, and they're doing everything in their power to be like the West. Now, they also list something that's only happened in the last year or two, but is symptomatic of what's going on, a transition from labor scarcity to job scarcity. And he puts this down as one of the factors that are coming out or are part and parcel of this whole movement. The limits of some resources, oil, fresh water, and minerals. There, I think, has been talked of scheme where the ships come into Doubtful Sound and They take the water that comes down the tail race from the Manapouri scheme straight into the ship and cast it to those countries who haven't enough fresh water. I mean, this is fantastic, but it's being talked about. Now, the power of technology, of course, to affect environment is increasing all the time. Then there's the inflationary cycle in economics, which is increasing, although it's halted occasionally, but the graph is steeper than it was 10 years ago. And then there is the weakening of moral or religious influence. And this is also symptomatic of what actually has happened. Now, the writer here says there are two choices before us. One is the new industrial state, where wage and price restraints by bureaucratic government control. This means the loss of personal freedom and in its place rigid control, and very nearly, ultimately, a police state. Then he puts forward the second alternative, which all of you, when you listen to what he's got to say, will hope can be achieved in time. Humanistic capitalism. Decisions made by the individual must be compatible with the good of all. To build a world in which every human being shall be free to dedicate and develop his capacities to the full. Not through coercion, but with the aim that learning, which is very important, fulfillment, and becoming human, or that's expressing human qualities, is the all-important aim. Even suggests that jobs should be structured to fit the person concerned, not the person forced by the economic system into jobs which do not suit them. And this would bring back the pride of craftsmanship. A man called Victor Firkus, in this book again is quoted in his book called Technological Man, which I have not got, says that any technological industrial condition as we have today needs a philosophy of life. And here are the three points that he puts forward. The new materialism, which affirms that man is a part of nature that is always in process of becoming, a nature that is always in process of becoming. Just pure philosophical concept. A new holism, spelled H-O-L-I-S-M. No part can be defined or restricted save in relation to the whole. Exactly the concept of brotherhood that I put before you in the very early stages. The new immanentism. This means that everything being there at the present moment. The whole is determined from inside and not from outside. Contemporary political, military, economic, ecological, and social crises are reflections of underlying moral and spiritual crises, the moral and spiritual crises of civilization, and their resolution depends on the resolution of the deeper crises. In other words, the individual problem, the world problem is the individual problem. We have to change, and can we change in time? Man must acquire the necessary sense of responsibility for the impact of his own actions on the shaping of the whole. He must so internalize these ideas and make them so much a part of his instinctive worldview that they inform his personal, political, and cultural life. We've got to stop being units of self-interest. We've got to try and expand our understanding for the good of the whole of the world. And we haven't long to do it. Our generation, most of us are here, would be in a generation that's going to find this very difficult. But the young people today all over the world are moving towards this new concept of humanism. And this is, I think, the way in which the working out of brotherhood is being brought about. This is God's plan. Although we may not recognize it as such, because it brings with it elements we don't like, such as violence and so on. But the young people are building the brotherhood we have talked about. The elite of the young people of today are building the brotherhood we have talked about. But the building will have its birth pangs. And it will not always be a beautiful process.
in the way it works out.
So the next few years are going to be very difficult ones, must be difficult ones for the human race. Now the young people have a reaction against the establishment, as they call it, because they see things differently. They are not full of traditional prejudices and so on that we have. And we find it difficult to follow their reasoning, but I feel myself that their thinking is clear. It's not based on preconceptions that are limiting. It's based on what they think. And it's got behind it this sense of the urgency of bringing about brotherhood. They're bringing back human values, emotional values. And the hippies, I spoke to an American girl from San Francisco a while ago and asked her about the hippies. She didn't know what hippie meant. I think I should have talked about the ones that wear flowers in their hair. Anyway, this whole business of doing your thing, of being emotionally involved in other people's problems, is a thing that is very general among the young people all over the world today. And this is where they're coming back to emotional values that have that sense of brotherhood or unity behind them. Then there's a new understanding of the family. In New Zealand here, James K. Baxter, the poet who died longer, lived in Jerusalem, remember, Maunganui, he put forward a concept that I find quite a number of the younger ones have accepted, that the basis of family has put forward in the Maori ideal or the Chinese ideal, where the older people live in and pass on their sense of protection, their sense of cohesion, and their help to the younger members of the group, is a very valuable one. And there's a certain criticism of the family unit as it exists in the Western world on this basis. I was interested to find that the New Values Party had in its manifesto, election manifesto, quite a number of these ideals. Now, the whole problem, is there still time to change? Can humanity change in time? How much are we doing? How much have we gone in defiance of God's plan? How flexible will that plan be? How because man has taken over to some extent, how is the plan and man's will going to be reconciled? Because fundamentally, humanity, we have to be changed. I do think that brotherhood has to come very rapidly if humanity is to survive, possibly another 50 years. And this, I think, is real. There's another book here that I haven't had time to read yet called The Closing Circle by Barry Conmaner, which is the environmental crisis as looked upon by the thinking minds of America. And believe me, although this idea has grown in the last 5 years, we've become conscious of the need to cooperate with our environment and preserve our environment, still the problem is an immediate one. You remember that HPB spoke many, many times about the Kali Yuga, the black cycle, the dark ages that we were to go through, and she threatened, she often painted a very drastic picture of the row that's got to be hoed by humanity in the future. And in the Mahachohan's letter, there's that little phrase that I haven't written it down, I didn't have the book with me, where it says that humanity is rapidly being divided into two classes, one of which is accepting the idea and submitting to the idea of self-annihilation by self-centeredness, and the other section of humanity is depending upon or expressing the ideas of self-interest and materialism, and in saying in effect that both those lines of which humanity is treading at that time, 1887, were leading to a crisis just as we now have confronting us. I believe that the masters of the wisdom are very aware of this problem. And I think that one of the reasons, perhaps this is a very difficult thing to say, but I said earlier that I could feel that the idea of brotherhood has been given to the world. And in many ways it's done its job with extraordinary success. But the working out of the development of brotherhood and the ideas of brotherhood in a practical way is something that I don't think we as a society can... We haven't done it very well. Perhaps we could have. But we're not doing it at the moment. Now, how it's going to be done? Who is being influenced by the masters of the wisdom at the moment to bring about these changes? I don't know. I think we ought to think about this and try and see what's happening. Because we are essentially dedicated to the idea of brotherhood, and it's up to us, all TS members, to be aware, even more than other people, of exactly what is happening in the world. We cannot hide behind what sometimes is looked upon as an oversimplified philosophy of life that has been put to the world as theosophy up to the present. We have to move, and I know you've discussed this in your meetings, we have to move, we have to somehow or other get that concept, the basic ideas of theosophy in a form where they will appeal to the younger people of the world. Those younger ones who are today wrestling with the problem of bringing about brotherhood. Not the idea of brotherhood, but bringing about brotherhood in the world. And bringing about brotherhood in the world in time for civilization to be saved.